There's no such thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Rabbi's guest this morning is Joshua Rosenblum, author of the fascinating new biography, A Very Unusual Way, Mari Yeston and His Singular Path to Broadway and Beyond. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's extremely evident that anti-Semitism is permeating many aspects of American politics in ways we haven't seen in decades, if ever. That was clear in the Democratic primaries held last week, particularly in New York City and state, where a series of progressives who ran as much against AIPAC and Israel as they did against their opponents won pretty much all their elections, often defeating more conventionally liberal pro-Israel candidates. When the largest Jewish city in the world by population, New York City, is electing people who promise to attack Israel and stop all aid going to it and who use profoundly anti-Semitic tropes throughout their campaigns, attacking Zionist conspiracies, calling Jewish organizations monsters, normalizing vicious terrorism, violence, murder, and rape as resistance, and so on, man, we have a huge problem here. Perhaps most mind-boggling about these recent election results is that some significant proportion of Jews have chosen to vote for these progressives who advocate profoundly anti-Semitic stereotypes, who claim that Jews have no right to their own nation, and that Jews are not originally from the Middle East. Oh, and that it's perfectly okay to violently attack Jews of all ages everywhere and anywhere in the world. Colorado, Michigan, London, Montreal, Sydney, if you disagree with Israel's actions. The clever political analysts now say that supporting Israel is a liability in elections all across America. But this isn't about whether or not Israel should attack Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. No, it is about Israel having any right to exist, something that somehow is never on the table for any other nation on earth. You know, I recently forwarded people on my social media feed a short article by the clever atheist thinker Sam Harris, who wrote about how many of his more progressive followers were highly critical of the fact that Sam Harris supports Israel in preference to the radical Islamists who seek its destruction, Hamas, Hezbollah, and so on. I certainly don't agree with Sam Harris' theology. He is a philosophical atheist who believes firmly that God doesn't exist. But I am quite grateful for his intelligence and forthright approach to a very real situation, and I don't think I could agree more with him on this one. As Harris says, I'm not interested in exploring all the ways Israel has missed the mark, from Prime Minister Netanyahu's corrupt alliance with the far right to the many crimes committed by settlers in the West Bank to the deaths of innocent non-combatants in several wars, because none of these failings, however grave, will alter my sense that, first, the ethical difference between Israel and her enemies remains vast, and second, the global preoccupation with the Jewish state, as though it were the worst villain among nations, is contemptible, the product of perennial lies and delusions. I think militant Islam is 10 times worse than you think it is. When I talk about jihadists and their various groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, the IRGC, that's Iran, etc., I'm talking about people whom I consider to be worse than Nazis, jihadists being essentially Nazis who are certain they're going to paradise. My views about the conflict in the Middle East will not fundamentally change unless my critics produce evidence Israel has become as evil as her enemies. You can rest assured that if somehow the IDF morphs into a death cult that uses its own civilian population as human shields and yet somehow remains widely popular, If ordinary Israelis suddenly begin to celebrate martyrdom above every earthly priority, producing generations of bright-eyed suicidal fanatics, if residents of Tel Aviv condone the taking of Palestinian infants, old women, and other non-combatants as hostages and then gather in crowds of thousands baying for their blood, if, in other words, the Israelis begin to resemble the Palestinians, then I won't care who wins this war. Short of this, there remains a world of difference between the two sides. I believe that we should focus on how brutalizing it is for any free society to confront enemies that sincerely claim to love death more than everybody else loves life. For this has been Israel's predicament for the better part of a century. As Sam Harris continues, the problem in the Middle East is not and has never been the existence of the State of Israel. The problem is jihadism, Islamism, Islamic extremism, Islamofascism, militant Islam. Whatever words you want to use to describe the belligerence and triumphal lunacy of those who take the most pernicious doctrines of Islam too seriously. What do Jews and Muslims in the region really yearn to accomplish? What are they willing to sacrifice for? What are they willing to die for? What are they willing to let their children die for? If the Palestinians laid down their arms, there would be peace. If the Palestinians simply stopped killing Jews and stopped building a culture that celebrates pointless murder and martyrdom as its highest values, there could be a diverse, tolerant, and prosperous society between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. There could have been one 80 years ago. But if the Israelis laid down their weapons, there would be a genocide. This was obviously true October 7th, 2023, and for anyone who has been paying attention, it has been true on every other day since the founding of the State of Israel. If Hamas had the power, it would perpetrate a real genocide on Israel. The group has affirmed its commitment to this project on countless occasions, both before and after October 7th. There's more. I urge everybody to read all of Sam Harris' extremely accurate and cogent analysis, in which he makes it crystal and clear that this obsessive focus on destroying Israel comes not from an idea of justice, just from good old-fashioned anti-Semitism and fanatical Jew hatred. Now, lest you think all this rising tide of anti-Semitism comes from the left, well, look to your far right, which includes prominent figures like the despicable Tucker Carlson, who promotes anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, ancient anti-Semitic tropes, and platforms neo-Nazis on his show, and of course hates Israel. There are now podcasters like the execrable Candace Owens, who has more reach than any American anti-Semite since Father Coughlin. There are plenty of white nationalists on the far right, and some are embraced by President Trump. Christian nationalism is an ever-growing part of national and regional politics. There's increasingly broad acceptance of insane anti-Semitic lies, which are everywhere online and on social media, and use evocations of manufactured falsehoods like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and that's on the right. When AIPAC, a lobbying organization that's had very limited success the last few years, is demonized as a monster by the mayor of New York and described by U.S. congressmen and podcasters right and left in terms that would make a czarist anti-Semitic propagandist proud, things have gotten bad. So, what's a Jew to do in this summer of 2026 when it seems like shouting anti-Semitic stuff is the in thing to do? Both sides of the political spectrum and increasingly sliding towards the center, in which anti-Semitism is the hottest hot girl of this hot summer, without in any way suggesting that we ignore anti-Semitism. The first most important lesson for all of us is to express our own Judaism positively. Do meaningful, enjoyable Jewish acts. Light candles on Friday night. Celebrate Shabbat with family and friends. Attend Shabbat Friday night services or Saturday morning services. Watch Jewish films. Study Torah. Hear Jewish music. Laugh with Jewish comedians. Do Havdalah. Cook a new Jewish recipe. And of course, listen to past two Jewish shows on podcast. The truth is that Judaism is a life-affirming, values-based way of life, a fabulous expression of an amazing, nearly 4,000-year-old tradition filled with joy and meaning. That's what Judaism is, and we need to embrace it in all of its beauty, diversity, and complexity. You know, for a long time, the Jewish community here in America has focused on supporting Israel, on remembering the Holocaust, and, oh yeah, along the way, embracing Jewish schmaltzy kitsch. But now it's belatedly responding to the sharp rise in anti-Semitism, and that's become the primary cause for many Jews. And as usual, there's lots of assimilation. But that's not what being Jewish really is. And always, as Jews, we have the opportunity to live our lives fully, wonderfully, Jewishly, in ways that enhance and elevate us spiritually, communally, intellectually. So my friends, yes, do fight anti-Semitism, but even more importantly, live meaningful, joyful Jewish lives. To play us in this morning here on Too Jewish, here's a song by the composer and lyricist who's the subject of the biography our guest has written. It's Mori Yeston's song from his musical Grand Hotel, the lovely Love Can't Happen.
Mademoiselle, I have followed you everywhere, almost throughout your career. London, Vienna, Paris, I've admired you, hoping one day we might meet in this way. But I never thought I'd get carried away. Oh, I knew you'd be beautiful, but not so beautiful. Why am I talking this way? Can this be real to me? Nonsense, my boy, you knew she'd be beautiful, but not so beautiful. Love can't happen quite so quickly. Not unless I dreamed you beautifully and sweetly. No, don't look through me so clearly. I might very nearly lose myself completely. Who could ever have suspected would make me tremble so? I can't think of any answer other than if love comes, when love comes, you know. What is this I'm saying? What is this I'm feeling? Like I'm getting drunk, looking in her eyes. Overwhelming face, utterly appealing. Never mind the truth, never mind the lies, never mind a thought in the world except love can't happen quite so quickly. I might very nearly lose myself completely. Who could ever have suspected trembling so? I can't think of any answer other than if love comes, when love comes, you know. And I
that was Love Can't Happen from the musical Grand Hotel by Mori Yeston. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest will be Joshua Rosenblum, a fine musician, conductor, and composer in his own right, talking about his own teacher and mentor, the remarkable Mori Yeston, whose journey to Broadway Tony Awards and acclaim came after following a completely different path than any other Broadway songster ever. Rosenblum's biography of Mori Yeston is fascinating. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
America was conceived in liberty, dedicated to the notion that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights. To preserve them, we gather to read and reaffirm the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 8:30 a.m. at Udall Park. under the Tree of Liberty in front of the Rec Center to read the Declaration together. On our 250th anniversary, let us be one nation, July 4th, 8:30 a.m. at Udall Park.
To play our guest in, here's a bit of Maury Yeston's wonderful song, You Are Music, from his musical Phantom.
Do re mi fa sol fa re fa mi, do re mi fa sol fa re mi do. Now you.
Do re mi fa sol fa re fa mi, do re mi fa sol fa re mi do.
Move the do. Do re mi fa sol fa re fa mi, do re mi fa sol fa re mi do.
Re mi fa sol fa re. Mi fa sol fa re mi do.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Joshua Rosenblum is a highly accomplished composer, conductor, Broadway and off-Broadway with a long set of credits. He has written a new book on a past guest and a favorite of Two Jewish, Maury Yeston, the Tony Award-winning songwriter. The book is called A Very Unusual Way, Maury Yeston and His Singular Path to Broadway and Beyond. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what prompted the book right now?
Well, this is my second book. First one was about Richard Maltby and David Shire, who are also Broadway songwriters. And my publisher liked that book and said, and I also felt like, well, now I've sort of figured out how to write a book. So maybe I said, is there someone else you'd be interested in having me write about? And they said, well, actually, we've been thinking about publishing a book about Maury Yeston. And I said, hey, that's a great idea, because I was actually a student of Maury's when I was in college, and I know him well, and I know his work well, and I would actually love to work on that. So 2 years later, here it is.
And he is celebrating his, or recently celebrated his 80th birthday. So
yes, indeed.
Always a milestone, a nice thing. Tell us a little bit about what made Maury's journey to Broadway so unusual. Of course, as you said, you studied with him. I should have mentioned you were Phi Beta Kappa at Yale. You have a few other accomplishments along the way yourself.
Well, thanks. So Maury's path, I think, was unusual because he started out as a music theorist and Yale professor. And when I was a student, he was the director of undergraduate studies. And he was very, very highly regarded and sort of had a celebrity aura about him even before he got famous as a Broadway composer, which was when Nine, his first musical, opened on Broadway.
Right.
And A Very Unusual Way is actually a phrase from one of the hit songs from Nine. So when I was a junior, the spring of my junior year, Nine opened on Broadway and turned into a big hit. It won the Tony Award for Best Musical and Best Score for Maury. So that by the time I was a senior, he was a full-blown celebrity on campus. You know, he had written a hit Broadway show. And in addition to being a highly regarded academic who had published two academic studies, he was also now a Broadway composer. So that made him very unusual, so to speak. And, you know, he was highly regarded both in the popular sphere, which encompasses Broadway, and in the classical sphere, which encompasses his work as a scholar and music theorist and a Yale professor.
It is definitely unusual. You know, we think about Broadway composers like, you know, Irving Berlin, who, I don't know, eighth grade education or something.
Right.
You know, immigrants, often Jewish, who came over or who kind of came up the hard way, or, you know, Tin Pan Alley or in later Catskills, whatever it was. But not a whole lot of academics composing for Broadway.
It's true. And the only person who really combines the quote-unquote serious music with popular music output in terms of being a Broadway composer and also a composer of classical music is that I can think of is Leonard Bernstein.
Right, of course.
Other than those two guys, there aren't too many in that category.
You know, and he was, of course, at the other team, Harvard, so it doesn't really count.
Exactly.
We will come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish with our guest, Joshua Rosenblum, talking about his new book, Maury Yeston, A Very Unusual Way. And we'll hear some of Maury's music as well on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established 7.5 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation, northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come to our services on our Facebook page. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Religious school is available for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, our terrific Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up or call 520-276-5675, 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events open to everybody. Come in person Friday night. Our Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study, open to everybody at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Each service is always followed by delicious food, a wonderful Onik Shabbat on Friday night, a delicious Kiddush on Saturday. Our services are also available on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our Adult Education Academy classes, which range from introductory Judaism through Kabbalah to the study of Tanakh, lots of wonderful classes are available in person and on Zoom. All of those are available on our website too, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, taught live and on Zoom in all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. We welcome our expert on international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, Tom, a couple weeks ago, for several weeks, we talked about colonialism and its impact on the contemporary world. One of the, I think, poorly known aspects of the whole British colonial enterprise in the 19th century, and particularly, was the involvement of a group of people that are often called the Baghdadi Jews, Jews from what is today Iraq. Wasn't Iraq back then?
Baghdad.
Yeah, Baghdad, right? Which was at one point the capital of a great Islamic empire, major city. Let's talk a little bit about that Jewish community and how they became so influential, still influential in many parts of the world.
Sure. So first of all, let's go back to what makes Baghdad so special. I mean, it's a very ancient city. Tigris and Euphrates, all that stuff, Mesopotamia.
Cradle of civilization, the first city states.
Pre-biblical.
Right.
Okay, but then in the history of Islam, Caliphate moved around a little bit until it settled pretty stably in Baghdad for a very long time until the Ottomans conquered Constantinople and moved the Caliphate to Istanbul. And that wasn't until 1453. So there were probably 700 years when the Caliphate was in Baghdad. And not only was that the capital of the vast Arab empire that you will remember included Spain and all of North Africa.
Of course.
But
nearly France, actually.
Right. It was also the seat of the Reish Galuta, which means the head of the Jewish diaspora.
Right, sometimes called the exilarch, like the exile head, right?
Right, but that was a purely fictional concept. Basically, the caliph wanted one interlocutor for world Jewry, and he wanted that interlocutor to be located in Baghdad. So this position was created not really by the volition of Jewish people or Jewish Baghdadis, but the volition of the caliph who ran the empire and for his administrative convenience wanted there to be kind of Jewish counterpart with whom he could communicate, debate, whatever. So this office was set up, and there were also, even earlier, the great academies of Torah study and eventually Talmud exposition in Sura and Pumbedita.
Of course, yep.
So Iraq in general and Baghdad in particular played a large role in Jewish history for a variety of external reasons, not intrinsic to anything having to do with Baghdad, really, or to anything having to do with Jews. However, the Baghdadi Jews became very prosperous because Baghdad was the capital of a huge, far-flung multinational empire. It became this great trading entrepot. Stuff came from the east and was shipped to the west, came from the west and was shipped to the east. And even though it doesn't seem natural or logical for this inland city to be a major entrepot, it was, just because of who was living there and who was skilled at this and also who had the facilities, linguistic and otherwise, for long-distance commerce, like multinational, far-flung commerce that extended over, you know, 5,000-6,000 miles. When the Brits exerted some administrative control over Iraq starting back in the late 18th and very early 19th centuries, they were building an empire. They had clear imperial ambitions. You know, the sun was never supposed to set on the Queen's Empire in the era of Victoria, which was much of the 1800s.
Right.
The Brits were actively building an empire that was based on trade and commerce. And who better to take advantage of this than the Baghdadi Jewish community, which had done the same thing for centuries, and which could both enrich and profit from the British imperial enterprise. So the Baghdadi Jews, like, very quickly learned English. They settled in all the ports that were east of the Persian Gulf, whether India, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and particularly China, where the great Jewish families that we've talked about before lived to create basically all of modern Shanghai is due to two Jewish families.
That's right.
From Baghdad.
The Bourse there, the stock exchange, the large buildings, the Baghdadi Jews really created the financial center that became Shanghai, which is the most dynamic economic engine of modern China today. Tom, let's talk some more about this next week, because they were incredibly influential throughout India, many other places as well. We will talk next week.
Look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The old rabbi is in the hospital, barely conscious, surrounded by worried congregants. What a great speaker. His sermons were so inspiring, says one. He's the best rabbi ever, agrees another, and a great fundraiser, too. He took such good care of his family. Always he had time for them, no matter how busy he was. And what a brilliant teacher, says another. He could patiently explain Torah, Talmud, everything to anyone, no matter how hard the text or how ignorant the student. And a community leader, too. He was the best. After that, everyone falls silent. After a few moments of quiet, the rabbi weakly opens one eye and says, "And about my modesty, you say nothing?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a man, Pinchas, whose story started at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation is familiar by now. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy reaches epidemic proportions. Even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses very publicly. He takes a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly watches in horror. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, strides forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, according to the Torah, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to the story than meets the eye. Pinchas' reward for killing this couple is a brit shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or to carry a spear even. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, rituals of purification and sacrifice. He can never engage in any more acts of violence. Pinchas has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will his level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led the Crusades, or to Jihad, or the Inquisition, or today's religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our own Jewish religious fervor is designed never to lead to violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same brit shalom, the same covenant of peace that God places on Pinchas. So may it always be. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Joshua Rosenblum, will tell us his best Mori Yestin stories and share what's so unique about this extraordinary Broadway composer of Nine and Grand Hotel and Titanic. Find out when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Three important Jewish passings took place last week, two key figures in the entertainment world, and one aspiring jazz musician who instead became the most important financial figure of his times. Probably the greatest music executive in all history died last week at the age of 94, Clive Davis, the executive who steered Columbia, Arista, and Jay Records to the pinnacle of the pop music business in a dramatic 50-year career that accounted for the sale of tens of millions of records, perhaps hundreds of millions, while Clive Davis's life in the music industry fell into three distinct acts. In the late 60s, Davis, a Jewish guy born in Brooklyn and orphaned as a teenager who attended NYU and Harvard Law, Clive lucratively moved staid Columbia into the rock and roll business, signing or developing talents like Janis Joplin, Carlos Santana, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, Aerosmith, Loggins and Messina, Earth, Wind and Fire, Neil Diamond, and Chicago. Clive had a magical ear for talent. But after enormous success at Columbia, he was fired in 1973 for allegedly misusing $94,000 in corporate funds to pay for his son's bar mitzvah. 1973, that must have been some bar mitzvah. Eventually pled guilty to tax evasion, Clive rebounded at Arista Records, an amalgamation of losing labels owned by Columbia Pictures that changed when he arrived. Vocalist Whitney Houston was just the biggest and brightest star on a roster at Arista of top rock, pop, and R&B acts that included Aretha Franklin, Dionne Warwick, Kenny G, and Barry Manilow. Oh, Clive also started Arista Nashville, which launched Brad Paisley, Brooks and Dunn, and Alan Jackson, and then an L.A. offshoot that started a slew of successful rappers, although Clive Davis said he never understood rap music, but he promoted it successfully. 25 years later, after an awkward merger between parent companies Sony and Bertelsmann, an attempt to push Clive Davis out at Arista and into retirement resulted in a third act with something called Jay, a new imprint, best known for launching singer-songwriter Alicia Keys. Davis was so well known in the music industry, he was usually referred to just as Clive by his first name. Noted for his personal elegance, extravagant style, and love of limelight, Clive hosted a lavish Grammy Week party annually that was the music business's most coveted ticket. Clive also gave back, founding a school of music and business at NYU. Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name, and they're always glad you came. James Burroughs, a Jewish guy born in L.A., was raised in New York, is on the short list of the greatest TV directors in history. He won 11 Primetime Emmy Awards and was nominated every single year but one in a 25-year period, a quarter of a century, from 1980 to 2005. James Burroughs was the only director ever for the hit show Will and Grace, as well as a big director for Friends, Frasier, and Taxi. But he will always be best known for creating, with Glenn and Les Charles, the huge hit show Cheers, which ran for 11 seasons, became one of America's and my favorite show. Burroughs directed 240 of its 275 episodes himself. By the way, James Burroughs' father was Abe Burroughs, best known as the co-author of the show books for Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business, the librettos, and his dad gave him his start in show business after he graduated from Oberlin and Yale Drama School. James Burroughs moved on to the Mary Tyler Moore and Grant Tinker's MTM production team. He met her when he was working as a stage manager on an unsuccessful play she was starring in, and he got his start directing on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the Bob Newhart Show. Big or bigger in the 70s, as Cheers and Friends were in the 80s and 90s. In addition to Burroughs' central role in Cheers, Frasier, Friends, and Will and Grace, he directed a number of episodes of other hit shows, Rhoda, Phyllis, Laverne and Shirley, Night Court, Dear John, Dharma and Greg, Mike and Molly, Caroline and the City, the pilot of Two and a Half Men, and the pilot episode of The Big Bang Theory. In all, James Burroughs directed over 1,000 episodes of television, an astonishing number. In many ways, James Burroughs stands with fellow Jew Norman Lear as one of the central figures in half a century of TV sitcom history. He was a huge part of some of the best work done on TV in the 70s all the way to the 2020s. May he rest in peace, as his shows will live on forever in syndication. And finally, Alan Greenspan, the most influential Federal Reserve chair of all, died last week at the age of 100. Greenspan was appointed Fed chair by Ronald Reagan in 87. He remained in that office, reappointed five times until he retired in 2006. Long revered as an economic sage, his reputation for infallibility took a hit with the subprime mortgage crisis in 2007, a year after he left the Fed. But for a long time, he was a kind of rock star for the seemingly ever-growing American prosperity of the Reagan, H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and initial years of W. Bush's presidencies. Alan Greenspan was born in Washington Heights, New York in 1926 to Jewish parents from Hungary and Romania. He was on the way to a successful jazz music career in his teens. He played clarinet and sax alongside famed jazz star Stan Getz and then further studied clarinet at Juilliard from 43 to 44. He often said that Stan Getz changed economic history by being so much better than Greenspan was, he knew he couldn't match up, and so chose college and education over jazz. But among his jazz bandmates in Woody Herman's Herd Band was Leonard Garment, later Richard Nixon's special counsel. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Joshua Rosenblum is the author of A Very Unusual Way, Maury Yeston and His Singular Path to Broadway and Beyond. He has been himself, Joshua Rosenblum, not just an author, but a musician, conductor, composer himself. Tell us a little bit about what it is to write about somebody else when you kind of do some of the same stuff.
Well, I feel like it's helpful in that I sort of know the profession from the inside, and it's helpful because I have a network of people I can speak to who I know will take my phone calls, you know, that I want to talk to them and interview them for my book. And so that's helpful. And knowing what it's like to be a composer, I can bring sort of an analytical approach to looking at some of his songs. That's challenging because you want to strike the right balance. You don't want it to be too theoretical because you don't want to alienate lay readers who don't necessarily have a wide knowledge of music theory, but you want it to be interesting enough to musicians who are reading who actually do want to understand the songs on a slightly deeper level. So that's something I constantly juggle when I'm writing about Maury and his songs.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered in writing A Very Unusual Way?
Wow, good question. I knew that he had written a cello concerto and that it was premiered by Yo-Yo Ma. That was sort of part of the Maury lore when I was a student. But I never really heard that piece until I was working on this book. And when I heard the recording, I was astounded at how different it was from anything else of his that I knew. You know, it was a fairly vast, complex, challenging, spiky, contemporary piece. A completely different musical vocabulary from any of his musicals. But it's wonderful. It is wonderfully engrossing and interesting and provoking. But listening to it, you would never, ever say, oh, this is the same person who wrote Nine and Titanic.
Tell us a little bit about his collaboration with lyricists.
You know, interesting, there is very little collaboration with lyricists. He's a composer-lyricist. He wrote both music and lyrics to Nine and Titanic, and the songs he contributed to Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel as well, right.
And he has a version of Phantom. A lot of people don't know that. There's obviously the famous Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, that one is a little better known, I'm afraid.
Yes. However, the Maury Yeston Phantom has had literally hundreds of productions worldwide. So even though it was eclipsed on Broadway, and the Lloyd Webber Phantom is a huge international hit, Maury has been very successful with his Phantom. But to your original question, he has very rarely collaborated with any lyricists who were not himself.
How did he end up getting involved in Broadway with his academic pedigree?
Well, he always loved musicals. He told me that when he went to see My Fair Lady when he was 10 years old, it sort of struck him as this amazing thing. And so even though he always wrote classical pieces and was a serious academic and got all the way through his PhD, he always loved musicals and always wrote musicals. And he took, there's this program in New York called the BMI Musical Theater Workshop that was originally founded by Lehman Engel, who was a very prominent Broadway conductor. And Maury took that workshop for several years where people show up and write their musical theater songs and eventually write full musicals as their projects. And that's where he wrote Nine as his big project in the advanced class of the BMI workshop, which you get to in the third year. And they do a public presentation and producers show up. They're looking for the hot young writers. And there were a few producers there when he presented Songs from Nine, and they optioned the rights. And then it's a long, circuitous path, but 10 years later, Nine was on Broadway. And I think it was largely because he met Tommy Tune along the way, and Tommy Tune loved Nine. Tommy Tune, obviously, a famous director, choreographer. And it was Tommy Tune's clout that got Nine on Broadway.
So it's really Tommy Tune that eventually brought Maury to Broadway.
Yes, that is correct. You know, since this is a Jewish-themed broadcast, I thought you might be interested to know that he considers his Jewish background a fundamental influence on his music and his musical style. And not just for him, he points out that like 90% of Broadway musicals were written by Jewish people. And he thinks that you can hear a distinctive Jewish influence in the songs of most of the Tin Pan Alley Broadway composers of, you know, the whole last century.
Sure.
He's very eloquent on that subject.
Tell us about, you know, Nine and kind of his breakthrough, really his journey into Broadway from academia and his relationship with Fellini.
Yes, that's very interesting. So Nine, for those who may not know, is based on the Fellini movie 8 1/2, which is probably Fellini's most famous film, and it routinely shows up on a lot of critics' lists of the top 10 movies of all time. 8 1/2 is very highly regarded. And Maury saw it when he was a teenager and fell in love with it. And when it came time to write a musical for the BMI workshop I was referring to earlier, he said, I'm going to write a musical based on my favorite movie ever, 8 1/2. And his joke is, and I'll add a little music and I'll call it Nine, which is a good laugh line.
It sounds like Maury Yeston. Yep. You know, it's such a crazy idea, really, to turn that into a musical. But the source of musicals, Titanic, Grand Hotel, these are, they're often a little bit off the wall, aren't they?
Yes. He has had what he would admit are some very bizarre choices. You know, Titanic was ridiculed before it opened. Everyone just assumed, well, you know, singing, all dancing, all drowning. You know, the headlines wrote themselves.
Right.
But it turned out to be very highly regarded, and there was a revival recently at City Center. There was a huge success, and you know, people nowadays consider it quite a successful musical.
Well, I mean, it did win the Tony for Best Musical, among other Tonys. You know,
I think the reviews at the time were a little mixed, but as you said, it won the Tony. Best musical and best score, and audience appreciation has grown considerably since then. Then another show of his that was off Broadway is called Death Takes a Holiday. So, you know, talking about unusual topics, there's a musical with death in the title. You're sort of asking for it. But again, it's a really beautiful show.
In writing about him, what was the hardest thing for you, Josh?
Interesting, because in a lot of ways it was easy because he's so eloquent, and I did like 15 interviews with him. I guess in terms of the music, there is so much to say about so many of those songs. I had to narrow it down and single out which ones I was going to analyze in some depth because you can't go into depth about everything. So I wanted to pick songs that people largely know, but there are also some undiscovered gems that I wanted to make sure I covered. So sort of weeding through it and singling out what I was going to go a little deeper on, that was definitely a process.
What are your favorite songs of his?
Well, I actually list them at the end. I say these are the ones that stay with me. There's a song from Nine called The Bells of St. Sebastian that I really love. There's a one-off that he wrote that's called Strange, which is a cabaret song he wrote for this French chanteuse that he is friendly with. And that's really gorgeous. Most people don't know that, but it was featured in, he had an off-Broadway review of his songs a few years ago called Anything Can Happen in the Theater. And that cast recording is available, and you can hear Strange on that one.
You guys have set up a special concert to promote the event, the release of the book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. It is this Monday, June 29th. And it's at Symphony Space in New York, in case you have any listeners in the New York area. And it's going to be Peter Felicia, who's a well-known theater journalist. He's going to interview me about the book. And Maury's going to make a special appearance. And we'll have a Q&A with the audience. And the best part, interspersed with the interview, is going to be five prominent Broadway performers, and they're each going to sing one of Mari's most beloved songs. And so we'll have musical performances as well as discussion, and then a book signing.
So Amori's 80. He didn't feel to me like he was slowing down at all when we spoke to him a year or two ago.
Yeah.
Do you think he's
still pretty sharp?
Yeah. Do you think he has more musicals left in him?
He told me that he is mostly interested in writing classical pieces at this point. He says that that's what draws him most. He hasn't done that in a while, and he wants to sort of get back to writing pieces for the concert stage as opposed to for the Broadway stage.
Nice to be able to have that option, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. yeah, not many people can say that.
I can't think of too many. I guess Bernstein had that option, but...
Yes, like we said, not too many others.
Not too many others. What's your favorite Maury Yeston anecdote?
this is the one that I sort of lead with, and it... You know, he's good-natured about it. It's sort of poking fun at his ego, but he doesn't mind when I tell it. In fact, it's in the prologue to my book. But so this goes back to we were students in the 1980s. I'm a senior, and Nine just opened on Broadway the previous spring. And he's teaching this class called the Analysis and Composition of Song. And we're on our musical theater unit, and we're talking about lyric writing. And he says, writing lyrics is a very special skill. It's different from poetry writing. It's a unique skill unto itself. And there are five people today who are truly outstanding at it. And these are the five great living lyricists. And he said, there's Steve, and he of course meant Sondheim.
Sondheim.
He said, there's Alan J. Lerner. There is Ed Kliban, who was the lyricist for Chorus Line. Sheldon Harnick, and me, quite frankly. He included himself on the list. And so I was a little worried when I showed him my manuscript and included that as part of the prologue, but he thought it was hilarious.
Well,
let me put it in.
Yeah, it's good that he let you keep that in. That's a nice list. Sheldon Harnick, of course, Fiddler on the Roof, and She Loves Me, a bunch of others. I want to thank Joshua Rosenblum for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people find out more about you, find out more about the book, A Very Unusual Way, and maybe go to see the concert on Monday?
You can go to rosenblummusic.com. That's my website, and it'll link you to the book launch event that's this Monday. And it'll tell you there are samples of my own music, you know, my compositions from both theater and the concert world.
And at Rosenblum is Rosenblum.
Yes, thank you very much for that.
Well, you know, as a rabbi whose last name is spelled Chon, I have to be sure I've got the spellings correct.
Right. So. I can imagine people get that wrong occasionally.
Everybody. Josh, thank you so much. All the best.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Rabbi Tracy Kaplowitz, coordinator of the recent Recharging Reform Judaism Conference in New York. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30, Saturday morning 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org for services and class schedules. Sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Maury Yeston's Tony Award-winning show, Titanic. We'll meet tomorrow. My friends, have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
is sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.